Thanks, Tom. Good afternoon. Well, we're not too thin. We have a couple of visitors here. If you count Mr. Bowman, he's been here quite frequently lately. Mr. Perner came all the way from Milwaukee to... Well, we were talking before services, Chuck and I, about what if nobody shows up, we'll just have to talk to each other. But it's pretty encouraging. A lot of you came anyway. And welcome those who are peering in from that camera back there. Hope you're hearing us okay. I have been, in the past 3 years now, on the subject of the heresy in the New Testament, taking the books and the letters in chronological order. We've scanned the composition of those letters and books, starting with the earliest indications of false teaching in the church. Early on, in the late 50s, we saw some indication in the letters to the Corinthians and the Galatians and Romans. But in the 60s, Paul's attention centers mostly on the region of Asia, in Asia Minor. Increasingly, he writes Colossians that is increasingly focused on Asia when he writes Colossians, Ephesians, Hebrews. And then a few years later, after his imprisonment, he writes the two letters to Timothy, all to the province of Asia. And then after his death, Peter and Jude take up that fight, writing to the same audience, I believe, after Paul's death. But then after the 60s comes a long, long dry period. Of course, in 70, Jerusalem is destroyed. And the Jerusalem church is scattered, but then the Apostle John, apparently sometime after 70, moves to Ephesus, moves to Asia, the new center of the church. And in the 80s, I think it was the 80s, maybe a little later, John wrote his three epistles, general epistles that I covered last time, or time before last, all plainly, those epistles, all plainly battling the heresy in Asia, taught by a particular heretic recorded in history as by the name of Cerinthus, and I spoke about that. But now in the 90s AD, John is an old man. The church is embattled, both from without by persecution from the Roman Empire, and within from this continuing heresy. And in the 90s, John writes the revelation of Jesus Christ. It is the revelation of Jesus Christ. We believe it is inspired. But Revelation is written by John. It's a prophecy, of course. Obviously, the book of Revelation is a prophecy. But in the second and the third chapters of Revelation, Paul writes to the seven churches of Asia, Paul's churches. And those messages contain some descriptions of the heresy, some characteristics of that heresy that I want to go over today. And I think it's the same heresy that we've been seeing since the late 50s, starting in Corinth and onward, 30 years before. So I'll finish my chronological series today with a scan of Revelation's messages to the seven churches of Asia. And we'll be looking for what the heresy was according to the book of Revelation. The churches of Asia, of course, were not where the heresy began, but it seems to have quickly settled there. It becomes the center of Paul's focus earlier on, as I said. Recall that the churches of Asia were not planted until Paul's third journey. He had skipped past Asia on his second journey, but he preaches briefly at Ephesus at the end of his second journey. But then on his third journey, about 55 AD, he goes overland straight from visiting the churches in Galatia. He goes overland straight to Ephesus for the first time. And Acts 19 records that he spent 2 years there. So this is really the planting of the Ephesus church. 2 years spent in Ephesus, and it was during those 2 years that he got to know a lot of people in Ephesus, converted a great number of people, knew them very well. At the end, in fact, of those 2 years, he writes the letter to the Corinthians from Ephesus. And then he went from there, from Ephesus, he went over to Macedonia and to Greece, where he wrote 2 Corinthians and Galatians and Romans. But he had left behind that large church in Ephesus, And that is why I think that in 57 AD, approximately, when he writes the letter to the Romans, that monumental size and important letter, he also sends a copy of it back to Ephesus. I think that is evidence, I brought that up before, I think that is evidence in the last chapter, the 16th chapter of Romans, is a greetings to a great number of people that he knows very well, and they all seem to be the people of Ephesus. So it seems that he sent the letter to Rome, but he made a copy of it, attached this chapter 16, which is a greeting to all the people in Ephesus, and sent that letter to Ephesus. That was one of his warnings against the heresy, really. I mean, in that book, he is fighting against the premise that God is not faithful, which is a Gnostic premise. Anyway, after writing the book of Romans, he goes on his way back from Greece. He stops at Jerusalem. He's on his way to Jerusalem. He stops on his way to Jerusalem at Ephesus once again. And in Acts 20, we see the famous warning. Read it before, but it's important. Acts 20. Paul calls together the elders of Ephesus. And in verse 28 through 30, he says to them, "Take heed to yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to feed the church of God, which he has purchased with his own blood. For this I know," Paul says he sees something coming, "that after my departing will grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. And also of your own selves will men arise," that is from the elders of Ephesus, "will men arise speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after them." So this was written, well, this is written in the 60s, when Luke recorded this in the book of Acts. But Paul could see it coming back in the 50s. And that's probably why Luke records it here in the 60s, that Paul could see it coming and now it's here. He's fighting the heresy in Ephesus. Now, there's no record that Paul ever preached in other cities of Asia. That is, he preached 2 years in Ephesus. There's no record of him teaching in the other churches, but he quite obviously made disciples who took the gospel to the other cities of Asia and raised up other churches. It was a few years later, for example, after this warning in Acts 20, Paul is imprisoned in Rome. An elder comes from Colossae, Epaphras, and he's got a problem, a serious problem in Colossae with the heresy, and to that, answering that problem, Paul writes the book of Colossians. And not only to the church in Colossae, but also, he says, to the church in Hierapolis and the church in Laodicea, which were close by Colossae. So there were other churches, obviously, in Asia besides Ephesus, raised up by maybe Paul's evangelistic team, which would include such as Timothy and Titus, people that who had been converted in Ephesus, like Epaphras, who raised up churches in other cities of Asia. Anyway, this warning in Acts 20 was not Paul's last visit to Ephesus. He goes back again after his imprisonment. 1 Timothy records that he again visited Ephesus at least once after his imprisonment in Rome, and he speaks in 2 Timothy of that visit, saying that some false brethren in Ephesus did him great harm, did me much evil. He writes that in 2 Timothy. So that's the background of the churches there. Now we come to the book of Revelation some 30 years later, and John addresses these same churches. If you turn to the book of Revelation, Revelation 1, verse 4, John to the seven churches which are in Asia. Grace be to you and peace from him which is and which was and which is to come, and from the seven spirits which are before his throne. Verse 10, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet saying, I am the Alpha and Omega, first and last. And what you see," it's this inspiration from Jesus Christ, "what you see, write in a book and send it to," the seven churches which are in Asia. And he lists them here. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, and Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Now there might be some prophetic meaning to these seven churches, but I'm not going to address that issue today. I'm not talking about the prophetic implications of those seven churches at all. But there were indeed actual seven congregations in those seven cities. From Paul's letter in the 60s, we know that there was already a church in Laodicea, which is the seventh one in the list here. So these were all historical churches. We'll see that they all had similar problems at that same time. They were all real congregations and contemporary with each other. And the first one, as you know, is Ephesus, chapter 2. Ephesus. Unto the angel of the church, of Ephesus write, these things says he that holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. He commends them, I know your works and your labor and your patience, and how you cannot bear them which are evil. Well, there are lots of kinds of evil, but what kind of evil is he talking about? And you have tried them which say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. That's the first indication of this heresy. The men that trouble the church in Ephesus say they are apostles. Now, we've seen that before. If you remember way back in the letters to the Corinthians, that was a problem in Corinth. There were false teachers there who claimed to be apostles, very spiritual apostles, but claimed to be more spiritual than Paul. They claim to know God personally, to have experienced God personally. They said, were not taught by mere men, as Paul was. And then also in Galatians, written about that same time, he's fighting the same problem in Galatia with a charge that Paul was an inferior apostle, that he'd only been taught by the men, the apostles of Jerusalem. He had not known God personally like they had. To the Corinthians, and I'll just quote a couple of verses about these false apostles, when he wrote the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 11:5, Paul says, I suppose I was not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. Tongue in cheek, he's saying. Who are the chiefest apostles? Those who claim they are chief apostles, superior apostles, spiritual apostles. They claim to be apostles. 11:13 in that same book, 2 Corinthians 11:13. He says, for such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. Well, here in the 90s, in the city of Ephesus, they are still apparently saying the same thing, here in Asia. And John answers, you have tried them which say they are apostles and are not, and have found them liars. Liars, that's a word that the apostle John tends to favor, calling spade a spade. Remember in 1 John 2:4, he says, I know, he that says, Paul writing to the churches of Asia in 1 John 2:4 says, he that says, I know him, which was the Gnostic claim, I am familiar with him, I know him personally, I have experienced God, and keeps not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. That's the same wording here. You have Ephesus has come to see that those apostles who claim to be apostles are liars. John says, you cannot bear them that are evil. They do not keep the commandments of God. They are the same apostles that he addresses in 1 John. Verse, continuing here in Revelation 2, verse 3, and have borne and have patience, and for my name's sake have labored and have not fainted, all the good things in Ephesus. Nevertheless, verse 4, I have somewhat against you because you have left your first love. Still, there is another thing positive about Ephesus. Verse 6, but this you have. You still have this. You hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. The Nicolaitans. According to Irenaeus, writing in the 2nd century, the Nicolaitans are the followers of that Nicholas, who was once one of the 7 first ordained deacons of the church. That's according to Irenaeus. Irenaeus is connecting them with Acts 6:5. And that in that event, I'll just quote you from Acts 6, it says, And the saying pleased the whole multitude, and they chose Stephen as a deacon, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Nicanor, and Timon, and Parmenas, and, 7th, Nicholas, a proselyte of Antioch. Irenaeus says that Nicholas is whom the Nicolaitans are named after. Well, we don't know that for sure. The Nicolaitans were named after somebody named Nicholas, but whether it was that Nicholas or not is really uncertain. There are other writings, ancient writings, that claim that Nicholas the deacon was of good character. But Irenaeus goes on to say this about the Nicolaitans. They, the Nicolaitans, lead lives of unrestrained indulgence. The character of these men is very plainly pointed out in the Apocalypse of John, which you're just reading here, when they are represented as teaching that it is a matter of indifference to practice adultery. They are sexually loose. And 2, to eat things sacrificed to idols, according to Irenaeus. These are the practices of the Nicolaitans. Wherefore the word has also spoken of them thus, but this you have, and he's quoting John here from the book of Revelation, this you have, that you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Irenaeus also says that this form of Gnosticism, which he does associate with the Nicolaitans, is a form that's a little earlier than the Gnosticism of Cerinthus. Irenaeus writes, John, the disciple of the Lord, preaches this faith and seeks by the proclamation of the gospel to remove that error which by Cerinthus had been disseminated among men, and a long time previously by those termed Nicolaitans, who are an offset of that knowledge, falsely so called, which Irenaeus is tying back to 1 Timothy, where Paul writes that of the Gnostics. They have a knowledge, falsely so called. He says that is the doctrine taught by the Nicolaitans and later by Cerinthus, that he might confound them and persuade them that there is but one God who made all things by his word, that the Creator is God, which is which is opposite of the Nicolaitan doctrine or the Gnostic doctrine. And then Irenaeus describes them as teaching those core ideas of Gnosticism. He says this, and not as they allege, the Nicolaitans, that the Creator was one, but the Father of the Lord another. That is, the Creator is one God, but God the Father is a higher God. That God the Father was not the Creator of the world. That's a classic Gnostic doctrine. And that the Son of the Creator was one, but the Christ from above another. That is, the Son of the Creator would be Jesus. He was one, but the Christ another. Another classic Gnostic doctrine. And that this creation to which we belong was not made by the primary God, but by some power lying far below him. So they did not believe that God was the creator of the world. The world was created by a lower being. Anyway, Irenaeus then in the 2nd century connects the Nicolaitans with Gnosticism. Number 2, Smyrna. Back in Revelation 2, verse 8. Unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, and this is the second city going up the coast to the west coast of Turkey, the province of Asia. Ephesus, and then Smyrna, and then Pergamos, the 3 major cities of Asia on the coast. They all competed to be the leading city of the province. Anyway, to Smyrna, these things says the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. Verse 9, I know your works and tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews, but are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Here's another characteristic of the problem in Asia. They say they are Jews, but they are not. This is an extremely interesting statement to me, because it's my understanding that Gnosticism originated among Jews. It's a Jewish philosophy. It was a professor by the name of Berger Pearson who first suggested that, or more than suggested, convinced me of that origin. Pearson is a professor of religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, also one of the translators of the Nag Hammadi text. Mentioned that, you know, trove of writing before they were dug up in 1945, original Gnostic texts, and he was one of the translators of them. Berger points out that the Gnostic ideas originated with biblical themes. They are biblical themes. And long before Christianity. Now, who reads the Bible long before Christianity? They are Jewish. Gnosticism was a reinterpretation of the scriptures to explain why God had failed to make the Jews great. Why hadn't God fulfilled his promises? Why are the Jews not a great people? And the explanation was, their explanation was, that the God of the Old Testament was not, obviously, the highest God. He didn't have the power to make them great. That the Creator God was ignorant of his own origin, and at worst, it was his object to keep down the offspring of the true God, the spiritual ones of the earth. It was his object to keep them down. And this was a radical reinterpretation of the Old Testament, of course. But it was done by people familiar with the Old Testament, which were Jews. It created a system, however, that was actually anti-Jewish, wasn't it? It's anti-Judaism. Certainly a radical departure from Judaism. But I think that it qualifies them for John's description of them right here. In number 2, Smyrna, them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. They claim to be enlightened as Jews, enlightened to the true meaning of the scriptures, but they deny God himself, the Creator. And claim he is not the highest God. Okay, number 3. Third church is Pergamos. Verse 12, in chapter 2, verse 12. To the angel of the church in Pergamos write, so we're going up the coast again here. The next city is near the coast. Sometimes called Pergamum or Pergamon. But it's the same city. For a time it was the capital of the kingdom. You know, the old kingdom before the Romans formed the province of Asia, it was the kingdom of Pergamum, and Pergamum was the capital. That kingdom was a descendant of Alexander the Great's empire. But still, in this time of being part of the Roman Empire, it was still an important seat of pagan religion. So he says, "These things says he which has a sharp sword with two edges." Verse 13, I know your works, and where you dwell, it's a tough place to live, even where Satan's seat is, and you hold fast my name, have not denied my faith. Even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who is slain among you, where Satan dwells. Not much is known of Antipas here that John speaks of, but some later writers say that he was an early Christian leader who had been ordained by John, and that he was martyred by Rome for refusing to sacrifice to the pagan idols or to the Roman emperor worship, which was also practiced there in Pergamos. And it's probably true. This tradition is pretty consistent with what John says is the problem here in Pergamos. They have not denied the faith in the face of persecution. But verse 13, but I have a few things against you, because you have there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, one, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, two, to commit fornication. Same problems. Now, on the subject of meat sacrificed to idols, Paul's letters, you know, they can seem a little ambiguous on the subject. For example, I'll just read you a couple. Remember back in 1 Corinthians 8:4 says, "As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice to idols, we know that an idol is nothing," which seems to be saying it's okay, you know, meat sacrificed to idol doesn't hurt the meat because an idol's nothing. "And there is none other God but one." And Paul also wrote in 10:25, "Whatsoever is sold in the shambles that eat," asking no questions for conscience sake. So Paul is saying, it seems to be saying it's okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols. However, I think the issue raised by the teachers in Corinth in the 50s was those who claimed to be free to eat, not only to eat, but to partake in the worship of idols in the pagan services because they were spiritual. Whatever they did in the flesh didn't hurt anything. They were spiritual. They were free to eat whatever they wanted to practice whatever they wanted to. Paul's seeming liberalism then on the subject of eating meat sold, that liberalism stops with anything beyond eating meat sold in the shambles, in the public market. I think it's clearly meant that meat that is known to be of pagan idol worship origin is not to be eaten. Paul makes that pretty clear, I think, in 1 Corinthians 10:21. You know, I'll just quote you one verse out of there where Paul concludes, I think it, you could call this a conclusion, 10:21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You can't do both. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of devils. To eat what you know has been part of a pagan service is to eat of the table of devils. Don't do it. But the Gnostic teachers are claiming that their spirituality makes their participation in these physical things of no concern to them. They are above it. And thus they embolden Christians to partake in what they know is part of pagan worship. And for this, John condemns them. And I think right along with this attitude toward partaking in idol worship, the Gnostics hold the same attitude towards sex outside of marriage. Once you are spiritual, it does not matter what the flesh does. So John is writing here, like Balaam, they lead Christians to be free from the Creator's repressive laws, which they would say are repressive. They destroy Christians by promising them freedom to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication. And in verse 15, going on here, "So have you also them that hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which thing I hate." So again, just as in Ephesus, this is an early form of Gnosticism. And these are doctrines of the Gnostics. Number 4, Thyatira. To the angel, 2:18, that is chapter 2, verse 18. "To the angel of the church in Thyatira write," Thyatira, now we're moving inland. You know, go up the coast, 3 churches, and then inland, and 4 churches lying in a line toward the south. First one is Thyatira. "These things says the Son of God, who has eyes like unto a flame of fire, and his feet are like fine brass. I know your works, and charity and service and faith, patience and your works, and the last to be more than the first. But," verse 20, "notwithstanding, I have a few things against you, because you suffer that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols." Same doctrine again. But you're curiously taught by that woman Jezebel. No one seems to know who that woman Jezebel is. And I think the apostles rarely dignify the opposition by naming them, giving them names. And perhaps Jezebel here is only symbolic, but I lean to the belief that she was a real individual. And I say that because the Gnostic myth included a lot of female personalities. And the Gnostic myth seemed to promote the pagan significance of sex and human reproduction. The male-female relationship thus had a spiritual significance to them. They might have had sexually related ceremonies. But their spiritual significance to sex was quite different from what Paul taught. And this might be the reason that Gnosticism included women teachers or women in leadership positions much more than the Jewish tradition. At least that's the way the early Catholic writers such as Irenaeus and Tertullian describe it. So it's easy for me to believe that this woman, Jezebel, was literally a female Gnostic teacher. But whoever she is, whether she's symbolic or real, we see here that she seduces Christians to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. And this is exactly what the doctrine of Balaam does in Ephesus, and it is what the Nicolaitans teach according to Irenaeus. Okay, number 5, Sardis. Chapter 3, verse 1. Unto the angel of the church in Sardis write. So we're coming down the river valleys in the interior of Asia now. Sardis is about 30 miles south of Thyatira. These things says he that has the 7 spirits of God and the 7 stars. I know your works, that you have a name, that you live and are dead. Verse 4, you have a few names, even in Sardis, which have not defiled their garments, and they will walk with me in white, for they are worthy. John does not seem to refer to any false teachers in Sardis. However, it does seem to me that the influence of the false teachers had a sullying effect on the church, a dirtying effect. So the fact that they had not defiled their garments seems to me that they had resisted that doctrine. Number 6, Philadelphia. Verse 7, 3:7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, and so Philadelphia now is the next one down the line, about 30 miles southeast of Sardis, straight inland from Smyrna. These things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that is of the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. I know your works, I've set before you an open door, and so on. You know you have kept my word and not denied my name. But verse 9, behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. False teachers are the same as those in Smyrna, contemporaries. They say they are Jews and are not. Right? They are Jews by birth, but not in doctrine or behavior, certainly. But I think this very strange Gnostic story, the very strange story that the Gnostics tell, was born in Jewish philosophy. They would say that they teach a newly spiritually interpreted understanding of the scriptures. But they do not practice the plain meaning of the scripture. Number 7, Laodicea, 3:14. And under the angel of the church of Laodiceans, this is another 40 miles south, about 100 miles inland from Ephesus. These things says the Amen, the faithful, the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Verse 15, I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were cold or hot. And, of course, you know the problem in Laodicea. However, like one before it, nothing is said here about false teachers. Despite all its problems, and Laodicea has its problems of not being hot or cold, at least Gnosticism doesn't seem to be a problem in Laodicea, which is a little ironic to me, considering that Laodicea is right next to Colossae, where the problem began in Asia. The letter to the Colossians was also sent to the Laodiceans. But apparently, Paul's fight against the Gnostics in Colossae has had a, maybe, I don't know. Perhaps that's the reason why they don't seem to have the problem in Laodicea. So in the scan of those seven letters, we've seen evidence, I think, of the Gnostic heresy in at least five of the seven churches of Asia. And that's not surprising. It shouldn't be surprising given the common knowledge that Gnosticism flourished at the end of the first century. But I think it's worth adding these characteristics that we see here in Revelation to the list of the characteristics of the heresy that's been going on ever since 1 Corinthians. And that's been sort of my point in the last 3 years up here, is to describe the characteristics of that heresy that has run through the New Testament. Now, why is this important? Why bother to establish the singleness of the heresy and the nature of the heresy? Gnosticism troubled the church up through the 300s for maybe 350 years, but it's not a problem to us today, right? It's not significant. Nobody but a few fringers ever pay any attention to Gnosticism today. So why bother? Well, what does trouble the church today? What religious idea troubles the church today? I think that the Christian world around us is saturated with the idea that Paul fought against Judaism. That's the way they interpret his words. Particularly that he was fighting against some Jews in the church who wanted to make Christians into Jews. Wanted to have them do Jewish things. That's the position of most of the commentaries that we will turn to on the subject. And that against this Judaizing within the church, Paul is upset. And Paul's big idea is that the Old Testament and the doctrines and the covenant of the Jews has been done away with and replaced by a new covenant, that we are not under such Jewish things as circumcision, for example. It's a big deal in Paul's writings. And that Paul warns us not to be so Jewish as to keep Old Testament laws like the Jewish Sabbath or holy days or kosher laws. They're all Jewish. To most Christianity, that is clear in Paul's letters. And the religious world who believes that way has used certain of Paul's arguments as clubs against you, against the Church of God. I'm speaking to you, of course, who are survivors of those beatings. You know that that such an interpretation of the scripture makes no sense. You know, it is inconsistent with the vast bulk of the Bible and what it says. But 25 years ago, there were 150,000 people numbered in the worldwide Church of God. And then a man came to power who was converted to this Protestant doctrine and these interpretations, and so was his son and others whom he promoted to power. And they turned tens of thousands of people in the church to Protestantism, virtually, to the Protestant doctrine. And all of that is based, I'm saying, on the premise that the Apostle Paul was fighting Judaism. That Paul's arguments against circumcision, his arguments for salvation by faith instead of by works of law, his arguments for not regarding days, and his words about holy days, new moons, and Sabbaths, were a battle against Judaism. But they were not. That's what I've been saying for 3 years. They're not against Judaism. A battle was against Gnosticism. The Gnostic teachers were Jewish, but they did not teach Judaism. Circumcision was a Gnostic doctrine, so important to remember. When people are trying to get other people circumcised, assuming they're male, they're not trying to get them to obey God as Jews. That's a Gnostic doctrine. Gnostic myth was a certain Jewish reinterpretation of the Old Testament. But works of law were Gnostic practices. Paul does not denigrate the obedience of God that's taught in the Old Testament. You know, the parts of the holy days, new moons, and Sabbaths that the Gnostics advocated were not obedience to God. All of this kind of thing. You know, the scriptural clubs that were used against the Church of God have to be instead understood in the context of who the apostles were fighting. And that, I believe, is the value of identifying the opposition in the New Testament.